Jack Wrangler's been just about everywhere in the world of show business. By the age of 8, he was playing the kid in an award-winning soap on television. He did bits in The Mod Squad and Bonanza in the 60s, and Dinner Theater when Dinner Theater was in its heyday. Wrangler's trod the legitimate stage, and that stepchild of the film industry, movies with a double X. These days, this still young man is writing, directing, and producing from his home in New York, dreaming up new bits, a novel, and a musical, and collaborating on their birth. I'm Susan McGinnis. Today on Conversations, a man who seems to be enjoying every one of his 9 lives, Jack Wrangler. What were you doing at the age of 8 that took you into a soap?
I was trying to get over being 7. At that time, I grew up in Beverly Hills, California, and I remember at the time, we always sounded like we were being very grand when we said that, so we never told anybody that we were from Beverly Hills. We said L.A., or we said, not even Hollywood, that was bad too. But Beverly Hills had a connotation of all these rich people sitting around, you know, sort of living off their parents' money, which was actually kind of true. I remember Jerry Lewis's kids used to tip people $5 to carry his briefcase to the bus for him, but we weren't brought up that way. However, being surrounded by all these celebrities and stuff, there was... As a kid, you kind of were out of everything. You really weren't involved that much, and your parents kind of kept you under wraps because, for one thing, it showed their age, and the more you grew up and they didn't, the more it started to look a little strange. And I felt sort of invisible, or, you know, like Cellophane Man or something. People kind of looked through me towards my parents because of my dad being this producer and my mom this real beautiful lady and this actress and everything. And I was going to a Sunday school that Eleanor Powell, the great song and the great tap dancing lady and all that, she was my Sunday school teacher, and which was not unusual. Jimmy Stewart used to read the scripture there, and Greer Garson would do a thing, and I remember they used to bring the Bonanza group down there to do the Christmas pageants and stuff. It was a very networking kind of church. And I remember doing my lessons in class. She'd have us memorize little things and stuff, and I memorized them quickly, and she felt that I had kind of an animation about the way I said things. And so she had me audition to play her son in the series. And I auditioned, and I got it. And we ran for, I think, 8 years, something with that series. Now, gotta understand that this was the time they had trouble with censorship in television. And everybody was very concerned about television having a high moral look to it, and we were the cleanest show on the air. As a matter of fact, the line, "The family that prays together stays together," was something that I or Ellie said every week.
This is called Faith of Our
Faith
Children,
of Our
right?
Children.
It was a Sunday soap opera?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Good,
and
clean show.
Very clean show, and I don't know anybody that ever saw it. Nobody has ever said, "Gee, Jack, we miss you in all that faith." Since then, it weren't the Brady Bunch, or it wasn't that kind of thing. It wasn't like everywhere I went, people were just falling over me. But also at the same time, this was in the early 50s, 1953, 54, and at that time, color television was just coming in to its own, and they did things in those days with color that were called spectaculars. Whenever they did anything in color, it was a spectacular, whether it was or not. And it was a different studio that did them. And so I remember doing the Faith of Our Children thing, and then being police escorted, which was really exciting, where they changed all the lights and all the signs, to get to the other NBC studio in Burbank to do this color show. And then they had me. I remember the first thing I did with it was I was supposed to be what everybody thought a child actor, the way they lived. And they were also trying to take advantage of the colors. So they had me waking up in this very large bed with 16 different telephones on the headboard, every one of them a different color, right? And that, which got in the Peacock and everything and pushed NBC. And I would wake up and take all these calls and field all this stuff and make all these business deals and jump around and everything. And that was the gig. And that was the only time I really felt kind of important as an actor, as a kid actor. Otherwise, I went to regular school and I just we rehearsed, I think, in the middle of the week, and then I did the show on Sunday, which was live, and then was kinescoped and came back to New York.
Huh. This is Jack Wrangler. We're talking on Conversations. Jack's dad was Robert Stillman. Robert, that's right.
Robert, right.
Robert Stillman. For 14 years, he produced the series Bonanza, which most anyone who's ever watched television knows about. His mom was what's known as a Busby Berkeley girl, right. An actress, also in a lot of commercials growing up. Was Hollywood a dream world, not quite real?
For kids, it was like a small town and the greatest place to grow up in the world. Every kid knew every other kid on the block. We all went to, like, elementary school, El Rodeo, and then there was Beverly Hills High and stuff like that. And we all had our little bicycles, and we all ran around the neighborhood, and we did the same things that any other kids did. Our houses were bigger, but we didn't know that that was any big deal because we hadn't seen much of anything else. We hadn't been exposed to that much more. In those days, you didn't see everything on television because, you know, there wasn't that much going on. And downtown in Beverly Hills, everybody, every shop owner knew all the kids, knew all their families and stuff. Everybody was on a first-name basis. It was a very conservative, very pretty neighborhood to grow up in. And there was no feeling of Hollywood type thing at all, not to any of us.
Small town, safe,
yes,
secure.
Yes, exactly that. Very 50s sitcom, very Ozzie and Harriet kind of thing.
Everybody asks the parents, adults who are in theater or movies, would you want your kid to join this business?
Yeah.
You joined the business.
Yeah, but they didn't want me to.
That was my question. What did the folks want you to do?
My dad wanted me to be an electrical engineer or a lawyer, so he bought me The Life of Clarence Darrow and a chemistry set. And I remember going out to our pool house, this house thing behind the pool, and shooting off cherry bombs so that he would think that I was doing something really productive with my chemistry set. And I didn't, I wasn't interested in any of it. And the Life of Clarence Darrow, I don't think I actually read until I was about 36. But it's a wonderful book. I wish I had read it. It wouldn't have encouraged me to be a lawyer, however. It's just a good read.
Did you have a sense you wanted to be in show business of some sort or another?
I had a sense that I wanted to be noticed. I wanted people to pay some attention to me.
The cellophane kid again.
Yeah. And I noticed that people that had a lot of wit and a lot of charm and were attractive really helped. Attractive was a big deal then. Pretty people was important out there. I was not this attractive kid. I was a scrawny little thing, and small for my age, but real thin. My sister, I remember, used to call me a dead weed, which left enormous scars for the rest of my life. I wanted to be this bigger-than-life person like everybody else was. That's what we noticed about our parents, that everywhere they went, they brought with them so much excitement. There seemed to be that it was a different world that they had than we had. And most kids were like that because their parents were so effervescent and so on, most of them. And I'm not talking about in a phony way. They just were bigger-than-life people. They, on our block was Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz and Rosemary Clooney and Oscar Levant and Frank Lovejoy and Ben Blue. I know people haven't heard of a lot of these people, but a lot of them, Jack Benny and Jimmy Stewart. That's all within one block.
Ooh, big and, people to look at when you're a little boy.
Yeah, and they were funny, and they told great stories. And people would sit around. I remember sitting around the pool and watching people like Alfred Hitchcock and people laughing and having more fun and getting a kick out of life. And then these very somber children that we all were sort of in the background, not being clever or funny and thinking, what is wrong with us? Mm-hmm. So that was my need. My need really wasn't to go in the entertainment business. My need was public love, I think, or any kind of love.
Sends people to the therapy couches.
Yeah, or into the entertainment business, and then into the therapy kind.
So in some ways, I mean, you describe Hollywood as a small town, close, warm, normal.
Yeah.
But there was this other side that was...
Sure, but that was also true of the Ozzie and Harriet Perfect Family, too, which we all see now, is that when you grow up in a conservative upbringing family where you dress nice and everybody has sort of the same values and stuff, and you ride little bicycles to school and everything seems kind of pleasant, and you know the cop on the block, you know your teachers and everything. It sounds like a perfect upbringing, but there are other things. We weren't allowed in the living room. We were not allowed in the big dining room unless on a special occasion we ate at separate rooms than our parents. We had to dress up to go to the big dining room. That was a big deal, and we hated it. If we were not allowed to be in, there were certain areas of the house we were not allowed in at all. They were strictly for our family unless on very special occasions, that kind of thing. It was not our home. It was theirs. And we were given the luxury from time to time of sharing moments. We were always reminded that this did not belong to us. So there was that, and plus the remote quality of our family. My dad, when I was a kid, was away a lot. He was shooting things in Brazil, and he was all over the world. And he also was having some rough times of things, and he would bring all that back with him. And he was a very tense man, I remember, in the early 50s, because he was having trouble with a film called Americana, and somebody tried to kill him, and there was all kinds of junk went on. And my mom was very nervous. She was running this huge household. And you think when you have, we had all the servants and stuff and everything, which also were very much closer to us than our parents were. So we didn't think of them as servants. They were closer part of our family than our parents. But my mom had to run all of that. She had to make all the decisions for the household. And to run a big household is tough. Doesn't leave you much time to put a kid on your lap and hold them when they start to cry.
We've talked before. You've talked about insecurities coming out of this thing here. When did you start to figure out that it wasn't so much that Jack was weird, but that the environment was a little strange? Is that much later?
Yeah, much later. Also, I was a sensitive kid. You know, people can have several kids, bring them all up the same way. One kid's going to react to it really heavy duty. Another kid brought up exactly the same with the same amount or the same lack of love or closeness to the family, and it rolls off their backs. My sisters, they didn't react that way at all. But I was the sensitive kid, and so I reacted very strongly to it. I don't think that I realized it was my father having problems with getting close to anyone until I got out of prep school. I was sent away to prep school in Rhode Island, and I think when I came out of prep school, I began to understand my father a little more for some reason. I think because I saw it in other people and their families, and I saw families where they were really alienated and the kids were mistreated and stuff. We weren't ever mistreated, and I never felt that my father didn't want to reach out to us. I just felt that he didn't know how.
You got to that point where you got a little more information, a broader spectrum of information, saying, oh, wait, it's not all like this, but people do grow up in families that are odd, a little trouble.
Yes, and actually it turns out that that's more the norm, it seems, than not. The family where people hug and kiss and tell each other they love them each other all the time, that's very unusual, and it doesn't guarantee that you're going to come out that great anyway. You may resent that. You may feel smothered. I mean, it's a go figure thing. I mean, with kids, Jesus, you know, you're doomed if you do and you're doomed if you don't. So I don't feel that my parents gave me any more extra baggage than any other parents. I was a sensitive kid. There was nothing they could do anything about.
Yeah. Growing up in that time, I grew up in that time too.
Yeah.
It seems to me in retrospect that raising, that rearing, makes the Ozzie and Harriet story behind the story all the more poignant, because we were all looking at these perfect families on television and saying, ooh, it's not like mine. Mine must be weird.
Yeah.
And then we find out 20 years later, geez, these people had a tremendous time.
Oh, it was really tough, especially for them. I knew Ozzie Nelson because I did a play, then he followed me in a show that I was doing somewhere, and cold, cold man, very austere man, and a man that those kids never got close to him. Harriet was the warmth of the family, but those kids had having to work every day. And as they said, they didn't do it because they asked to do it. They had to do it. They were told they were going to do it, and they were going to play this perfect family and everything. The fact that they came out of it so well, with so few scars, it really amazes me. And then it was so awful when they went through that whole routine when Rick died, that they thought that because of it blowing up as a freebasing thing and all that, and then they found out afterwards it had nothing to do with that at all. It was a heater that had messed up. And you know, that was that little announcement after blowing it all over the pages that, oh, freebasing and everything, oh, yeah, boy, we can really lock into this one. Then the admission that they were all wrong and it was a faulty heater was this tiny little thing on page 10 or something in the newspapers.
Yeah.
So we tend to go for the throat with these people. Must have been rough.
Must have been.
Yeah.
You're listening to Conversations on KUAC. This is Jack Wrangler. Jack has been in a tremendous range of show business opportunities. Stage acting, his longest runs have been in Life with Father, a year. He toured in Sunday in New York, The Impossible Years, Generations, Star Spangled Girl. He's been a director of a number of first name stars. Did dinner theater to put yourself through Northwestern. Well, sort of. I mean,
yeah. Oh, well, sort of. My parents were paying for the education, but I wanted the perks. You know, I wanted the neat apartment downtown. Even though I was in a fraternity, I wanted a nice place to go to, and I wanted some clothes that I had my eye on, and a lot of other things. And that I financed by doing theater in Chicago.
Northwestern is known as a creative, experimental, top-notch performing arts school. Did you find it that way?
Yeah, I did. It's a wonderful university. It depends, though, really what you want to go into. For the theater, you can't do any better. It's just sensational. However, if you want to be in film, you might be better off going to UCLA or USC because they've got all these producers and or producers representatives that have their eye on every film student that comes out of there. It's funny because today, the performing arts school thing, I had a meeting with a girl that she said, you know, you were talking about that yesterday, the big advantage of being at USC or UCLA. Well, I went to UCLA and it didn't happen for me. So, but you do have more of a chance being in the environment where people are going to take a look at you for film and pull you right out of there and give you a crack at something. Northwestern, for me, was the greatest thing in the world. First of all, it's a great campus. The people that go there are, at least when I was there, wonderful students, wonderful teachers. We had a ball. There was a certain amount of party atmosphere at Northwestern when I was there, too. It was kind of loose and nice. And after going to a strict prep school, boy, that was terrific. And then there was all this theater. There were tons of theaters all around the area and opportunities. I got a chance to play opposite Ann Southern and Joan Blondell and Tom Ewell with Life with Father and Gene Crane, and I mean people that taught me things from their viewpoint of how to walk on a stage and own it. And gee, I learned a lot, and it was an awful lot of fun too, and I was making money.
What dinner theater, you've talked about working for chains of dinner theater,
yeah.
Six and Seven Large in the chains, and doing
right.
Three or four shows simultaneously. Is there a tremendous grind to that, or is it just...
After a while, it got to be, and they all started to look alike.
Uh-huh.
It was, well, for one thing, I found out that if you do... They like to do the kind of fluff comedies, the lighter Neil Simon things, and a lot of other. I found out that if you were to build just a brownstone permanent set of New York brownstone, you could do 80% of the plays that are being done in dinner theaters. They always took place in a brownstone, whether it was a nice brownstone or a dilapidated brownstone. I wish. It's impossible to get a brownstone in New York. I don't know why everybody in all these plays lived in one, but they did. For having a chain of theaters, like at one point I had both Country Dinner Theaters and Windmill Dinner Theaters. Country Dinner, I think, had 8, and Windmill had 4, 5, or 6, something like that.
All in the Chicago area?
No. This was like Denver, Florida, Texas, all over the United States. So what you do is you'd have a home base for a period of time. Mine was in Florida, and you would mount the show in one theater, open that, ship it out, and bring in the next show, mount that there, and ship that out. And you just kept going from your thing. Now, when an actor OD'd or something in another city, and you had to quick run in and replace them with somebody else, or something happened with the show, or it was not working in another city because they were getting lax with it, you'd have to fly immediately there and do something, fix it. So you were constantly tending to your shows while mounting another one. And there was a lot of time involved. I remember once I made the mistake of getting romantically involved with somebody that was not in the theater at that time, and realized that there really wasn't a lot of time to do that. It was a 24-hour-a-day operation. And after a while, I got pretty sick of it. It was also in dinner theater, they've got this food, you know, that you know they keep reheating from night to night, and you kept seeing that same piece of roast beef sitting out there with these red lights on it to make it look real juicy. And I thought, I can't face that roast beef again ever in my life. And that was one of the reasons I finally thought that there's got to be something else in this world besides dinner theater. But I was making pretty good money, and again, I was learning an awful lot. I started acting in them, and then I had this really clever manager that said, Jack won't do it anymore unless it can direct. That's how I became a director. It was not like I aspired to it or anything. My manager just thought it would be kind of a good idea if I also did that, the next step. So he just said, if you want Jack to play the kid in one more show, he will direct. And the first show I directed was Gail Storm. Remember her? Mm-hmm. In Plaza Suite. And she was wonderful. She was just wonderful.
Yeah. What did you like best about directing? It was very different for you from the things you've done before.
Yes, I like the imagination involved in most of these cases. It was taking a chestnut and breathing new life into it, coming up with new ways of working it so that it would be fresh and be fun and exciting. I loved working with the caliber of people that I, at that time, everybody wanted to do. They were paying big salaries to these stars to go out and do, they were called star system theater at that point because always a star involved. And so working with people that were glad to be there, they weren't just there treading water. They were usually working on a project, and some of them went pre-Broadway, and learning from them, and it was never a power thing. I wasn't really crazy about everybody coming to me for the answer.
Mr. Stillman, we need your opinion on
exactly
this.
That kind of thing. This is to be a hanger or a hook, you know. My whole life became a hanger or a hook. I mean, I didn't like to have to come up with all the decisions and stuff. Plus, you had oftentimes 1 week to block them, stage them, and get them on. You didn't have that much time to work with character development. However, with some shows, I was able to tackle them a little earlier in California before we shipped them to wherever they were going to open and work with them. And then we had a lot of fun doing it. But I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Good.
Sure. Well, I have more questions about that later, so it's all right.
All right, because I thought I was done.
No. This is a reminder. You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM. And with me today is Jack Wrangler, a show business phenomenon from birth to the present.
From your lips.
Among your credits are 85 films that are in what we call the blue genre.
Yes.
X and double X films.
Yes.
You were still...
I'm very proud that I did that, you know.
Well, tell me in short, the source of pride, or someone else would respond differently. Why
can
do you say
that? Can I tell you how
that?
It happened in the first place?
Sure. Well, now we should start. You were Jack Stillman at that point.
I was Jack Stillman at that point.
That's how we start the story.
And remember, even though I was working as an actor and I had a certain degree of confidence on stage because I'd been doing it a lot, and I was directing, and I had a certain confidence in that area. Underneath it all was still this very insecure guy, very insecure about myself physically, always uncomfortable, feeling like I felt it's great to have, to be clever, to be an intellect, to be witty, to be charming even, if in fact I had little modicums of that. But to be lusted after. Mm. Now, that's something else again, and that I perceived from the time I was growing up. Remember I was talking about attractive people and attractive being a big deal in the Beverly Hills syndrome that I was in. Lust, there was a lot of power in lust, a lot of control, a lot of, you could win with lust if you lusted after. At least that's the way I looked at it. Now, this dinner theater stuff going on and on and on. Finally, besides directing in dinner theaters, I would act in any show I could possibly get whenever possible to get a relief from doing the dinner theater thing. And I was offered a play in San Francisco that was a non-union, non-equity play. Now, if you're a member of the Actors Union, you're not supposed to ever do a play that isn't a union show because they don't like that.
The worst kind of scab.
Worst kind of scab. And they not only fine you, they make you go to meetings as part of your punishment. And if you've ever gone to an equity meeting, you know that you just don't want it to happen again. And so I had been fined, and I had gone to the meetings, and I didn't want it to happen again. And so we were to open this play in San Francisco. It was only going to run for 6 weeks, and it was going to be a relief from doing the dinner theater thing. And the night before the program went to print, I said, well, we can't use Jack Stillman. They're going to catch me. They found me in Lubbock, Texas. They're going to find me in San Francisco. So I was wearing a Wrangler work shirt, and I said, look.
Works for me.
Why not call this guy? Besides, the part I was playing was this ex-hustler in San Francisco, now go-go boy, a bad one, from Arkansas. Dumb, but, you know, but warm and charming and all that stuff, supposedly. And so I thought, Wrangler, Jack Wrangler, perfect for 6 weeks. I mean, this is going to work great. I mean, it's a perfect guy to be playing this dumb guy from Arkansas. So, and make up a phony biography. So we said that I was from Minnesota. My name was Jack Wrangler. I had never acted before in my life, and that I wanted to be a forest ranger. That was the thing, right? And the show opened. No, I forgot to tell you. I took my clothes off in this show. I don't know how that escaped my mind, but that I did that. So the show opened. It got these really good reviews, Susan, right? And the thing ran for a year and a half. And I won the Drama Critics Award for the part. Now, of course, we went equity. We had to go equity to the show. Now we got this guy, Jack Wrangler, who is an equity actor, and he's on the cover and centerfold of every magazine because I've taken my clothes off in the thing. Also, all the posters. I was a featured player in the play to begin with. Well, once the show opened, I was over the title in the thing, and the poster had this blow-up of me sort of stripped to the waist and everything, and wearing these Levi's, and that's what they were using to sell the show. I remember my sister was living in San Francisco at the time, and I really hadn't mentioned that I was even in town because I was only going to be there for 6 weeks, right? Suddenly, she's seeing these posters over there, and
I know this boy.
Yes! But she wasn't even sure. She called me, and she said, Jack, what are you doing? And then on top of that, my parents heard about that I was doing this thing. You know, it started to be kind of known. But my mom got a little confused about it and thought, well, he's stripping in something. But there, she wasn't quite sure what. And there was this guy at the same time that was doing a strip act across the country called Jack the Stripper. So she figured, he must be Jack the Stripper. And Jack the Stripper set fire to himself every night on stage. So my mom calls me and says, are you setting fire to yourself on stage every night? And I said, oh, no, no, that's Jack the Stripper. I'm Jack Wrangler. And she said, oh, good. Well, she said, well, be sure to take your Theogram M. I remember her saying that. And she thought that would just, so whether he's a stripper or he's Wrangler, it'll solve everything.
Take your vitamins.
Take your vitamins. So anyway, I did this play, and then somebody said, how'd you feel about doing an X-rated film? Now, a lot of people disapprove of adult films. I never did. I had no reason to. I know that this, you know, this people hit this thing over the head in defense of X-rated films, but I frankly believe it. I think that that heavy-duty violence on the screen where people are smashing each other's heads in and killing 1,800 people in the first 5 minutes of a film and blowing up cities and blowing up each other and faces exploding and hands being chopped off and all that stuff. That might be interpreted as escapism, and if it is, fine. But I would be more apt to challenge that than people making love on the screen, which is also, as far as I'm concerned, escapism. I have never known of anybody going out and committing a violent act because they saw a sex film. They saw some. I've never heard of that. I've never heard of somebody carrying a dirty book in their back pocket and killing somebody while they've got. I don't see the connection.
But we're very uncomfortable with that kind of film. In Europe, it's more out there, more relaxed, and the films seem to have more credibility, more plot, more.
Yeah, well, we had plots. The films I did really did have plots, and most of them were made into R. We shot an R-rated version and an X-rated version of them, and the R-rated versions are all shown on television now. So there were enough plot that they could do that. I'm not as sure that we're uncomfortable with them as that it's a politically safe thing to challenge. It's a thing that any politician can get on a soapbox and say, let's get that smut out of those stores. And nobody is going to say, well, wait a minute, because publicly we are outraged by any kind of sexually explicit material. Privately, I'm not quite sure we feel that way because it's a multi-billion dollar industry and somebody's buying it.
Oh, lots of people. I cannot remember where I read it or precisely what the figures are, but evidently double X-rated videotapes are the second or third largest selling of all videotapes in the nation. That includes
Sylvester
Stallone, Disney, and all the rest, but very high up.
I think that at least at one point I got a figure, and I'm really bad with figures, because I've never actually gotten on a big deal about it. I did it, and I don't recommend it for other people, and I don't go out and talk about. I don't push it, and I don't even push the idea that people. The only thing that bothers me about it is that I know that I'd heard that it was 70% of all the films that are rented are X-rated films, and I think now the fact that they're on video cassette and you can take them into the privacy of your own home is a wonderful thing. One of the great things that people objected to was the movie houses that used to be family movie houses going X-rated because they found they could make more money on it, and it was a shame in the neighborhood, and also usually it was put in a neighborhood where then there was prostitution around it, and you know, it kind of snowballed, and I can understand that because of what was happening to the area. But now that it is something that's a private thing, it just seems to me that it's so easy for a guy that's running for any office to say, I'm going to take that stuff off the streets. I'm going to take it out of the market. And it's much easier to defend than the right to life or abortion or even contraception in schools. I mean, talking about selling prophylactics or anything. Everything is a sensitive issue. And usually a politician wants to get more power. Of course they would. They would want to get as many votes as possible, so they try to find something that's more or less politically safe. Mm-hmm. And boy, it's always the X-rated thing, and every year when there's somebody's up for an election, they get hit again. Anyway, that's my feelings about it. For me, here was this very insecure guy that was very insecure about himself sexually, and is suddenly people say, gee,
he's great.
Yeah, he's attractive. He turns us on. You know, there's something about him. There's a sexuality that's there's an animalism in him. There's all these things. Now I'm playing the part of this guy. I had taken the Jack Wrangler, and hopefully some of this was going to rub off on me, right? But the character I played in all of the films was generally a very. He had a street knowledge, he had an intuitive sensitivity about people, but he wasn't glib, particularly. He wasn't, which can get in the way sometimes of sexuality, or at least perceived that way in people's fantasies. He was very lasered in on his sexuality, and so became a sexual person. And people responded to it. They also respond because, probably because I was such a fraud, they probably responded to the vulnerability underneath it, too. And I know it was said there was a certain boy next door quality about the guys in the films, and that made people feel a little more comfortable with their sexuality, because they thought, well, this nice guy on the screen seems to not be uptight about himself physically. Why should we be? So I got a lot of letters like that, John.
This is Jack Wrangler. You're listening to Conversations. Since this era that we've been talking about, Jack's come out with an autobiography, The Jack Wrangler Story, or What's a Nice Boy Like You Doing, 1984, yes. St. Martin's Press. I'm going to skip around in time, but he's been working on a novel called Sellout. We'll talk about that in a little bit. He's been working with Margaret Whiting. Jack and Margaret Whiting have been here, and this is past tense because we'll be airing this later, with the Fairbanks Summer Arts Festival as teachers and performers. He has been lecturing at Eugene O'Neill as well as here in Fairbanks. A great number of things have come out, directing, producing, and writing. And that's what I think I want to ask you about next. A lot came out of this period of doing X-rated films.
Well,
for you personally.
It slammed a lot of doors in one way and opened doors in another. When I first went into it, my father said to me, he said, I hope you know what your next chess move is going to be.
Killing your career.
He knew that you had to go in with your eyes wide open. You weren't going to be able to do a television series probably ever again in your life. Film, maybe, but why would they take a chance on somebody that might morally outrage a percentage of audience and they might lose ticket sales over, when there are 10 million wonderful actors out there that don't carry that extra baggage? So why bother?
You weren't the only one. I mean, I can understand your dad's sensitivity, but certainly other stars ended
yes,
up in...
Yes, but with me, it wasn't just one film, and also there was a heavy merchandising thing that went on at the same time, and there was a certain... In the X-rated, if people knew about the X-rated industry, I was kind of a household word during the 10 years, and then a book about it as well. So there, it wasn't like I did one little film and was kind of swept under the carpet. This was, I wanted big reactions and I got it. I made as much noise as I possibly could about it. So, and then all the, from Donahue to all those wonderful talk shows too. So I think it was pretty well known that if I were to go back and try, it'd be silly to try to change my name back to Jack Stillman, because all I do is take... unless I wanted to try to have plastic surgery or something, people would know. And that means for people to take a chance on me in films, they might, but there's even a question about that now as an actor. In theater, no problem. As a matter of fact, in theater, I then started to get wonderful plays offered to me. And being able to travel across the country in new projects and new things, because I was a certain amount of a draw, and so it would help them with that. Plus, people were fascinated to find out that what this guy could actually do. The fact that I could even walk and talk at the same time, I think, was, you know, really amazed people. So I got many opportunities in the theater, and then as a writer. It was fine because I had written the book, and when the book came out, people responded well to it. It was critically well received, and the humor, I think, in it got to people. The sort of left-handed way I had of looking at things. People responded to that, and I was offered to write the book for a new musical based on an O. Henry short story called Alias Jimmy Valentine. The original short story was called A Retrieved Reformation, but it's about the greatest safecracker who ever lived. And I was offered to write the book and am salaried for it. In other words, I didn't have to go out and do something on spec because of my book. I was paid to write the book for a new musical. I'd never written the book for a new musical in my life. But I loved O. Henry because the stories were short. And I remember in school that I read all of that because it wasn't anything large that I had to read, and I had time for it. And I responded also to those wonderful characters. So that was so I got the opportunity to do that. Finally, the thing... people don't know about musicals. It takes forever to get them on. It was workshopped. It's been tried out in different cities. It's finally opening officially with a first-class production, starting in Concord, California, moving to Palo Alto, and then to San Francisco. And so we're on our way now. And then, of course, if it bombs, that'll be the end of that. But it's been a fascinating time working on that. That came out of the films, indirectly.
Is it exciting to have an expression of yourself happening on stage separately from you? Jack Wrangler is not acting this out. Alias Jimmy Valentine is taking place in Concord, Palo Alto, San Francisco.
I think what would be the probably the greatest charge would be to have 15 companies of it out.
Still into those large things.
Right. Big reactions. Right. That could turn my little head. Yeah. I could really get excited about that. But having one production open that's still a little iffy as to whether it's going to succeed or not until it gets the New York seal of approval, right now it's just a little scary and tentative. So I haven't relaxed to have a good time with it yet.
How did Sellout come about?
Sellout came about because there was this guy that I met named Foster Winans, who had written a wonderful book called Trading Secrets, which is an autobiographical account of his sojourn into the world of Wall Street. Having been a reporter out of New Jersey and a very impressionable young man, he went to work. This guy's such a chameleon, he can do anything. He went to work knowing nothing really about stocks and bonds. He just learned for the Wall Street Journal, and within a year was the co-author or with a byline of the Heard on the Street column, which is what every single stock person looks at every day, because it predicts, it talks about trends in the market and tells you where things are going. Well, this guy Foster, who had really not done all the, he'd been this nice guy from a nice little family, writing and stuff. This big guy who has helicopters and homes all over the world and junk and big clients comes to him and says, how would you like to come to dinner with me tonight? And I'd like to talk to you about something. He takes him to this fancy thing with all the limousines, all the junk and everything. He's never seen anything like this before. And he says, if you'll tell me what you write, you're going to write in that column the day before, we can all make a huge amount of money here.
This is the title, Trading Secrets.
Yes. And Foster was Thengalied by the guy. This is a nice guy that's never even stolen a Slinky in his life. You know, I mean, this is, and the only reason I said Slinky is because I did. When I was a kid, I got caught too. But he, you know, the wonderful, warm, dear man, and here he meets this guy, and he's snowed by it. He sees all the riches, all the stuff, and he thinks, what's so wrong? I mean, what's, you know, there's inside trading goes on all the time. Isn't this just sort of a bit of an extension of that? So the idea is he tells him what he's going to predict, and this guy sells on the prediction the next day, because stocks do rise and fall based on those predictions. So everybody's going to make money. Well, of course he did it twice, and they caught on, because the guy's doing the, you know, obviously makes sense. He's going to catch him.
He turns on the light switch, the light goes on. Somebody
knows.
Exactly.
He's caught. He's put in white-collar prison for a year, writes this wonderful book, and then gets out of prison, and the book comes out, and I meet Foster Winans, who I'm totally fascinated with, and who had read my book, and I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth, but he seemed to be fascinated with me, too. And I pitched an idea with him about a book that had been in my mind. I figured, after the autobiography, the next thing to do is do a novel. I wanted one of each. I want one musical, one novel, one autobiography, that sort of thing. All right, so I pitched him this idea of this book called Sellout, in which this guy supposedly has written a manuscript and stuck it away in the attic, forgotten about it. It's discovered, and through a series of circumstances, it turns out that it's very relevant for the 90s. And a very high-powered agent named Dorothy Lyman gets a hold of this thing. And she knows how to do a dog and pony show and sell things before anybody ever sees it, before anybody sees a line. She starts feeding one little chapter to each high-powered guy. She's got people bidding on this book and movie rights and subsidiary rights and everything to... and he finally ends up with not only a four-book deal from this thing, nobody's seen the book, but he's got a multi-film deal too, and all kinds of stuff going on. In the process, he's meeting all these fancy people, and all these. Well, his life just goes into it's a whirlpool of activities and things that are happening to him, and he's introduced to all the wonderful things that these people are all involved in and all their hang-ups, and goes right with it, and it practically destroys him and his family and everything else, and then the thing really twists and gets crazy. Lots of sex and drugs.
And sellouts in process.
It's in process now, yes.
Coming up maybe 92?
Yes, I would think so, because we did for almost 8 months a very detailed outline, which we worked together. Now, Foster just got a wonderful book deal of his own that he's working on. I got another thing, this Johnny Mercer musical deal that I had a deadline on. We both had deadlines, so we did the outline, and now we're scripting the chapters. But we're working on selling on 5 chapters and an outline. So even after it's sold, it'll be a period of time before it's out.
Sell out in 1992 or thereabouts. I do want to talk about the Johnny Mercer musical, but before that, you live with and work with cabaret singer, star for 50 years, Margaret Whiting.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in your work writing for her. Something in a little review caught my eye about a bit she does on TV commercials.
Oh. Yes, we, and now that's a part of a new thing. That's a theatrical piece that she's doing. We opened Margaret's show at Rainbow and Stars, which is at the top of Radio City in New York. I wanted to do something kind of crazy, but at the same time, it couldn't be too esoteric because they get a lot of people from all over the country that come in to see, and all over the world that come to Rockefeller Center and then go up to Rainbow and Stars. To look at the view and then to see the people that are there. And so I wanted to do an opening that could be interesting, and I thought, you know, all those commercials, the greatest hits of, and oftentimes it's some harmonica player or something that this guy, you know, he's influenced an entire generation, 16 generations of people, and you think, who is this idiot sitting on a stool with his harmonica? Well, I thought, why didn't we do open with Margaret sitting on this, in this light? You just see this light in her face, and they say, ladies and gentlemen, please pay close attention to your television sets. What you're about to hear may change your life. And then this whole big music segue comes up and everything, and then they say, for a limited time only, Crouton Records is proud to present a priceless collection featuring 14,000 of the greatest hits in the history of the world. And all this stuff, sung by the inevitable Miss Margaret Whiting. And then a light comes up and she mouths, you know, this section of a song. Then the lights go back down, and there's all these things about saying that...
Nonstop.
Oh,
for
yeah.
And
then they
years.
Say, finally, yes, right. It goes nonstop for 2.5 years and not available in any store. And then the end says, not only does Margaret sing all her greatest hits, but everybody else's as well. And then she comes up mouthing Connie Francis singing Where the Boys Are. Well, they got it. I mean, they are. And, it's a very funny opening to a show, and very personalizing for Margaret. And it's great. So now we're going to use it in the theatrical piece, too.
Is this all very collaborative when you work with Foster on the book, do you work with Margaret on the bits or other people on the bits?
Usually, I did the same thing with Foster. I have an idea and I sort of pitch it. You know, I'll say to Margaret, you know what I'd love to do for your next show? I'd love to do a thing on Capitol Records in years, but I'd like to take this slant to it, this take on it. And she said, well, that sounds like fun. Then Margaret in the back of her mind may have a bunch of songs that she liked to do in a segment, and then if I've come up with a hook on the way I'd like to do something, that's the collaboration comes really in after I've got the idea, and she said, you know, this song would work for it, this song would work for it, and we all, and also our musical director, Tex Arnold, who's been working with Margaret for the same length of time that I have. So it's the three of us that go to work on the project. And we start shaping it. And Tex has ideas about where the songs need to go and how they're going to work and complement each other and the textures of it. And Margaret has very definite ideas of what she's going to sing and how she's going to sing it and where and when. My job is to get the overall picture of the thing, write all the material for it, write the continuity, and then direct the piece.
Is it toil or a joy to kind of give Jack Wrangler up and become receptive to these other ideas as you create?
It's a joy. I don't ever feel like I'm giving up. I just feel that I'm opening myself to all the wonderful possibilities. I feel that these people are bringing me these great selections, and that I'm just helping them choose which selection might be the best choice for them, emotionally, physically, in the way they move or what they might do. There's so many, and none of these possibilities are wrong. It's just that there might be one that's the best, and I'm helping them find that. So it's a true collaborative effort. I never feel that I'm imposing on top of anything, and I don't feel I'm giving up Wrangler, because now Wrangler is me. For a while it was a character I was playing, but right. Now it's pretty much me. It used to be that when I was performing I was this guy, when I was directing I was this guy, when I was writing I'm this guy. Now it's pretty much the same thing. I write the way I talk and I direct the way I walk and talk.
With Jack Wrangler firmly in hand, are you looking forward to, so to speak, are you looking forward to the process of aging the next 20, 30 years?
No. That's big. I'm real uptight about all that. I had a birthday.
Stay in this place.
About 2 weeks ago. Oh, I want to get better. Yeah. 2 weeks ago, I had a birthday and went into heavy duty depression.
About age.
I thought, you always feel, first of all, you've wasted so much time. And I figured, I wasted tons of time here, and I should have done so much by this point in my life. And then secondly, it's like, I want to look good. You know, it's been part of the fun I've been having in my life. I don't want to look crummy. It's going to be, you know, a lot of kicking and yelling and stuff and all that thing. But there's so many things they can do now, Susan. They can, you
know, nip it and tuck it all the way up.
Well, right? Yeah, I figured that and if they can do that now, think what they'll be able to do 5 years from now when I'm really in trouble, you know? it's going to be real Dorian Gray for me.
With all the things you've done, is there anything that's come to you where you've said, oh, this is it, this is what I just adore? Is it writing or directing or collaborating or producing?
Tell you what, acting? I really would just adore is to have a show running that I wrote, a show running that I directed, a book out that's mine.
All of it at once.
And acting, and definitely all at once. Huh. Most importantly, all at once. Yeah. Even if it's just for one day, that would thrill me.
We'll order it.
Thank you.
Yes. Jack Wrangler, as a director, has directed the likes of Jane Russell, Catch Me If You Can, Sal Mineo, Sunday in New York, Gloria Swanson in The Inkwell. Betty Hutton will success
Here
spoil
today.
Rock Hunter.
Oh, Betty Hutton was a play called Here Today. Remember you asked
Here
me
today.
About that
That's
on the
right.
phone the other day. It's
That's
an
right.
Oppenheimer play, and I couldn't remember it.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Van Dorn was Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter.
There we go. Well, now I hope you've written all that down. Mamie Van Doren in Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter. Yes, indeed. And there's plenty more to come. We've moments left, actually, on conversations today. But tell me about the Johnny Mercer story. Wonderful writer.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, he was very prolific, and for almost four generations, 20s, 30s, late 20s, really 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. This guy was writing and still winning awards. To try to do a book show about his life, not just singing a bunch of songs, but actually with some drama in it about the man himself, is a real difficult undertaking, and it is not something that I thought was the greatest idea in the world. I was hired to write it. Mm. And other people had tried and failed. And so I don't know whether I'm going to fail or not. I came up with a hook idea on it, and it seems to be working for me right now in the writing. And I also have a wonderful collaborator, Irvin Drake, who's a great songwriter in his own right. He wrote When I Was 17. It's a very good year, and he wrote Tico Tico. you probably remember that song.
I do.
He wrote he wrote some really good stuff, plus a couple of Broadway shows like What Makes Sammy Run and all that. And we're collaborating on it, and he has a good take on the composer's side of the story, and I'm always looking for the fun, for the excitement, for the outrageous happening. And between the two of us, I think we're coming up with a pretty exciting book. But it means you're not going to be able to do all those damn songs. You know, you're going to do the songs that work with the book, and the book has to be as exciting dramatically as the songs. It can't be just waiting for the next number to happen. There's got to be that kind of attention. But really, Johnny is went through all the years of what happened to American popular song and the day they stopped playing those songs, when rock and roll suddenly shut it out completely. And that's what we're dealing with in the show, and how it affected a man whose very reason for getting up in the morning was writing songs.
Last question. Do you thrive on the kind of pressure you're under to create the great book to go with the great songs? Do you love it or hate it or both?
I like having done it. I like it when I feel I've accomplished it inside. I don't like the doing of it at all. I hate it. Right. And I'd always rather be on a beach somewhere.
This is an absurd comparison, but it's rather like plumbing. You hate it when you're doing it. You crack your knuckles and you break your knuckles, and it's awful and ugly, but the water turns on it. I did that. I won't tell you what I said while I was doing it, but I did that.
You did that all by yourself? I think to be able to plumb probably would be one of the greatest achievements one could ever, because it's really, to me, that's like magic.
See, you've wanted to do one each in your life. I could take you home. I have plumbing problems. You can work on it. Are you going to do more acting in the future? You did Soul Survivor.
Yes, this last year I traveled with that for about 7 months, and I loved doing that play. It dealt with AIDS and the issue, but it played against it and had great comedy, and it was kind of a Blythe Spirits thing, and I was a ghost, and it was great. I like to do one play a year.
Is you die and come back to tell your lover you don't want him to take another lover.
Right, right.
Don't throw
me
away.
He's dealt with my death. I haven't, and I'm the dead one. And I have no, I thought I was this pretty neat guy in his life, and I'm thinking, this guy's ready to move on? Well, I'm not. So I come back to annoy the hell out of him and the new guy that he's trying to take on and just disrupt the whole place, because I don't think, nobody could top that relationship that we had, and he's not about to try either, and I wreak havoc in the place. And it's funny, and then it becomes extremely poignant when we actually confront one another, and the whole thing of the need to give it up and move on in your life. You have to finally let go. So it was treated very well by a man that I didn't know. He died of AIDS 2 weeks ago. I did not know he even had it, and he obviously had AIDS while we were in production. Didn't know. A wonderful thing is that the play has companies running all over the United States now. Yeah, I want to do a new play every year. As an actor as well.
Jack, this has been marvelous.
Susan, you're wonderful.
This is Jack Wrangler. We've talked about a number of parts of his life. Do hope that Alias Jimmy Valentine takes the stage by storm.
Thank you.
That Sellout takes the bookstores by storm. And that pesky Johnny Mercer gets himself on paper.
Thank you.
Jack Wrangler has been in Fairbanks for the Fairbanks Summer Arts Festival, holding classes on writing, directing, and producing. This year also, he's been working at the Eugene O'Neill Center for the Performing Arts, doing the same sorts of work. Jack Wrangler on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you'll join me again next week.